Welcome to the Working Tools Podcast, where today we will begin our discussion of Observing the Craft by Andrew Hammer.
Ladies and gentlemen, brethren all, welcome to the Working Tools Podcast, a casual conversation around Freemasonry. First, it's important to note that our thoughts and opinions are our own and do not reflect those of our Grand Lodge or respective craft or concordant bodies. Please connect with us and ask questions via our website at theworkingtoolspodcast.com.
Today on the Working Tools Podcast, we have our usual group of hosts. We have Worshipful Brother Jared Dunham from Penticton Lodge number 147 in Penticton, British Columbia. Worshipful Brother Stephen Chung from Prince Charles 153 in Kelowna, British Columbia. Very Worshipful David Colbeth from King Solomon number 60 in Auburn, Washington. And I'm Matt Apple, and I'm a member of Mill Creek number 243, and we meet in Montlake Terrace, Washington. So today is the first of what will be many discussions of the book Observing the Craft by Andrew Hammer. It is a well-regarded, I would say, generally speaking, book on how to return, the importance of and how to return Masonry to its roots, I suppose, or its what he perceives as the pinnacle of a Masonic progress. Man, I'm already mal-assing this up pretty good, so maybe I should just punt to somebody else. So, David, how did we end up talking about this book anyway?
we were talking about how to start this show, and we were all, I think it's a late Sunday night, we're all kind of a little punchy, and I said, so who's going to talk about how we got here? And all the fingers were pointing on the screen to different people, and I won't mention what other fingers were expressed, but
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But I think the consensus in our group is that we wanted to talk about this because, as we understand it, this book, Observing the Craft, came out of Brother Hammer's review of, ironically, the Whither Are We Traveling series that we just finished. And so we wanted to extend that series and continue talking about some things. And originally we talked about trying to go into the other answer papers or even in the other papers that Most Worshipful Smith did. And we thought it might be a little redundant. However, even though Observing the Craft is a little bit of the same thing that Whither Are We Traveling brought up, I think it's a different twist. And essentially, I think he wrote a guidebook for those Masons and lodges that want to have some foundation in what might be considered as the origins of the craft, or what was his definition? He actually provided a definition, and I think I underlined it, but maybe I didn't. Now I'm going to have dead air here. I think that was one I wrote but didn't underline. He actually gave a definition of what this book is about, and I'm missing it. I know I wrote it.
I got it.
Got it?
Well, I got what I underlined, because I honestly, as far as I'm concerned, this is the blueprint for a good lodge.
Yes.
This is in the preface, he writes, okay, I got to put it away so I can actually read it. The book will steadfastly support the definition of the craft as a philosophical society,
yes,
which demands of its members the highest standards in all areas of its labors.
Yes.
Sorry, that's labor. Right.
I'd forgot that I'd written it in the first page of my notebook.
Yeah,
I thought exactly. I was just pointing to the exact line, just in case you had something different.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that I saw that after I've read this book and read the preface. I don't even know how many times I've read it. And then I saw it and went, wait a minute, there's the definition right there. He didn't bold it or italicize it or anything. It's just kind of slipped in there. So not to give this whole book away, but.
Well, and I haven't, you know, I myself, I've only gotten to the end of chapter 2, and I can wholeheartedly so far agree with these opening statements that Jared had about being a blueprint. So far, I'm just in I'm a little surprised though, because you know, he does focus on the fact that, you know, the statement out there of what we do is take good men and make them better. And then he goes on to describe what, you know, the being adjoining such an organization kind of meant. And I kind of got it, because I never joined to make myself better. It was an extension of my DeMolay family to me. It was a natural progression. And so, you know, as with everything else in life, it took me a lot longer to learn a few things. And obviously this was one of them, because it makes me, what I've read so far, makes me want to do those things. And I'm already thinking in my head, how can I present this to my lodge so that we could, you know, have a lodge that is observing. And I don't know how well that will go over, even though, like Jared said, it seems to be a blueprint for what we should be doing in lodge, right? He does make other quotes in there, and I don't know exactly where they are in there right now, but they refer to, you know, when we go to lodge, we just by observance of trying to hold ourselves to that higher standard, we dress well. We dress in a tuxedo, not just a suit jacket. We dress we work hard to perform our ritual well, and hold ourselves to that higher level, right? And to try and deliver to that, or deliver that impression to our candidates as they're going through. I thought it was so far, it's rather intriguing for me. So
I noticed in the opening, he talks about that so many of these things have fallen out of practice, and you know, of course, he's writing this in 2009, so it's almost, you know, almost 15 years ago. And but again, he was writing it, if our assumption is correct, he was writing it in addition to a paper that was written 40 years ago, 60 years ago, I guess now. And most worshipful Smith wrote in protest to things that had happened 40 years before that, and 50 years before that, and 50 years before that. So this seems to be kind of an ongoing thing that, and so maybe there is an underlying factor in how, maybe it's just people, it's men and humans, I think is probably the thing that causes this to continue, or maybe it's just cyclical. And so we've heard this before, it's an ongoing thing. And one of the things I wrote down, should some lodges ever have been chartered? No. Jared shaking his head, no. They shouldn't have been chartered?
All right. I've said this before. I'll say it again. The worst thing that ever happened to Freemasonry was that huge uptick after World War II.
Yeah, so, but as a brother,
I think that's actually what caused the problem. And I think that's what Most Worshipful Brother Smith was talking about, because he was talking about 25 years earlier, which would be prior to.
Yeah. But I wrote down, they must have been able to do the work, and, you know, doing, what does doing the work mean? That's not really being observant, right? That's just,
no,
they could do what the ritual and the code says.
Well, because technically, all you need to be able to do is have 16. Okay, well, I'm going to use ours. 16 master masons who can actually who can perform the ritual properly. That's all that's required.
See, Matt, even higher standards in BC Yukon, we only need 15.
That's because we have an education officer. But yeah, that in our code, that's all that's for, like. I mean, so I mean, it, that doesn't. Does being able to just being able to get through a degree without stumbling, is that, I mean, according, I don't want to jump ahead in the book, because, you know, I have read it a few times, but does that make a good lodge?
So yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. What is considered a good lodge? And I think, as you said, we'll get into that, right?
Yeah. But I mean,
one of the things is though that they can perform all the work. Now, does your constitutions also indicate that the sponsoring lodge, there's a sponsoring lodge, right?
Maybe.
So there's a lodge has to sponsor a lodge, a lodge that goes into dispensation, requests to be chartered. And at least, okay, in our code, that's how it works.
Yeah. I'll be back. Just let me go to the library for a minute.
I'm pretty familiar with it because, no, this won't become public until after our annual communication. So I'm pretty familiar with ours because I have a resolution that's not going to be brought to the floor because it was ruled out of order regarding lodge proficiency. And so in Washington, you have to have 15 guys, of course. You have to be able to do the work, but you have to have a sponsoring lodge. And that sponsoring lodge is essentially supposed to certify, whatever that word means, because it's the code is silent in that area. What is to vouch for? A sponsoring lodge must be able to verify or vouch for or certify that this lodge they're sponsoring can actually do what they say they can do. And they have all these things, 15 guys, free from debt, have a place for instruction, yada, yada. And then when they petition for their charter after their year of dispensation, then the Grand Master issues the charter. But again, there's really no certification of what this proficiency is other than they can do the work. Well, who and what sets the standard for what they can do the work? And I think this book goes into much more than just the ritualized side of things. We're talking more about the ritual and the work, making masons, basically, because that's what a charter lodge is good for, is to make masons. If you didn't want to make masons, you could do everything a lodge can do. You can have meetings, you can have fundraisers, you can discuss philosophical ideas, but the only thing that you can't do is make a mason officially. Right? No.
Or discuss things, Masonic.
Well, the circuit post for instruction.
Things aren't supposed to be discussed outside of a tiled lodge. Oh. You can't tile a lodge without a charter.
What can't you just talk about outside of a tiled lodge? That's a good question.
I don't know. I can't talk about it.
I walked right into that one.
I know there's a part of the third degree lecture in Washington here where it says that their true meaning can only be discussed within the tiled recesses of the lodge.
Mm-hmm.
So can you...
Are we digressing?
No. Well, I don't know. Can you not tile a lodge without a charter?
No, you cannot be a tiled lodge without a charter.
Well, what about lodges of dispensation then?
That's the dispensations. That's what gives them the right way to tile a lodge, is they have the dispensation to do it. It's what it means to be under dispensation. And Grand Master has said, yeah, we'll let you guys do this for a while until you either mess up or we'll give you your own charter then mess up.
Okay. It's the proxy for a charter.
Yeah.
I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, Matt. And I didn't connect in the degree that was a steadfast rule. Like I thought it was more of a, oh, okay, interesting. Now I'm going to have to go back and look at it.
And see what they're not rules per se, is such as guidelines.
That's the way I look at the code in general. Coach mode.
So we may be jumping ahead in my personal theorizing about this, but I in thinking about this book and the general the way that we have talked about the craft, about there are some lodges are more observant than others, more I don't know what the word is, esoteric than others, more making good men better, and some are more fraternal and some are more service oriented and that sort of stuff. And I was forming in my head the hypothesis, which may or may not be true, I haven't figured it out yet, that it's kind of like I've come up with a few different ones. The one I've come up with, which seems to be the least offensive, would be, although I don't know much about Buddhism, but in my head, if you had a Buddhist monastery, there are some guys there who are the entry-level novitiates who don't like, they're working on it and they're doing their thing. And then there's, like, you know, the guy who's the abbot or whatever, who's at the top of the pyramid. And maybe the abbot has been working at it long enough, and he's meditated and he's thought through issues, et cetera, et cetera. And he will achieve enlightenment. And he is not that any of the other guys couldn't, but it's sort of less likely, I guess. Maybe those other lodges that are not as observant need to exist to make it possible for the one percenters, for the top whatever top of that pinnacle of lodges to be, you know, masonry lodges kind of thing.
There's got to be a bottom to be a top, right?
Right. I mean, we couldn't all be, if we only let in masons and only allowed lodges to exist that were the freaking awesomest lodges, then what, I guess, would the other lodge, I mean, the other lodges wouldn't exist, would they?
We'd be able to raise our initiation fees and annual dues. Right. Well, you know, but that is what he talks about here, though. And when he talks about observing the craft, if it's just the old boys club, then that's not Freemasonry as far as it's described here.
He does allude that there's the opportunity for a religious observance connection, in that, you know, if a person or a religious belief is able to have diversity within their ranks, so should Masonry have diversity within their ranks. And I wrote it down as both a question and a statement, because I don't know that I, you know, in one vein, he says there's only one way of doing things, and here's the 8 steps, and we'll get into those in the future chapters. But then he also says, but there's enough diversity that every lodge can do whatever they want to do, and every Mason can be whatever they want to be. But this is the way it should be. And so there's seems to be that dichotomy of, you do whatever you want, but this is how it should be done.
I felt that same thing. There's almost a part of me that was thinking that he included, there's a line in there about, yeah, I hope that they will wish us well in the same way that we wish them well, kind of thing. And I sort of read that and went, I feel like he is, my apologies to Brother Hammer, whom I've never had a long conversation with, but I kind of felt like he was saying, you know, so when someone says that we're elitist or whatever, I can say, no, we wish them well. Look, I said it right here in the preface, kind of thing.
Well, like,
just to keep pulling on Matt's point. What I wrote that, and then I wrote another paragraph about it, and then later I wrote back, similar to what you're talking about, Matt. I actually put in, there must be followers to have students to have teachers. And so I think it is in line with your idea that maybe it's not the one percenter and the pyramid concept, but I think that there is room and opportunity for all, because there has to be those of us that men out there that are looking and seeking for the followers or joiners. And then those that are preparing, hey, we're ready for it. We're wanting to learn more. So we become a student. And then now, and then hopefully you then share that knowledge and become the teacher. My little philosophical idea.
Still haven't explained why whether other lodges should exist, because that would all happen in one lodge. Sorry, he has the line in here that, you know, I lost my spot. About, you know, the glory of Freemasonry exists whether we're 10 or 10 million.
Yeah.
It's not about numbers.
Yeah.
You know, I think I personally read the lines, you know, about, you know, yeah, well, they can go off and do what they want to do. They're wrong, but, you know, he's not about to. I think it's basically that he's not about to tell them, you know, well, you know, it's my way or the highway. That's fine. We're going to go off and do it our way. And, you know, don't get mad at us when we're different.
in that lodge of 10, are they all perfect then? Do you think?
I don't know.
Or is there one or two that are the perfect?
Okay, for one thing, we can't be perfect. It's impossible.
What?
Perfection is impossible. It's the striving for that is the important thing, not the achieving of.
Right. Yeah.
So stop saying about that. They're all perfect. They're all striving. They're all trying. They're doing their best.
Yeah.
But I want to. I like.
You forgot to add bless their hearts on the end of that.
Bless your heart. You're doing so well. When I read this book, it brought to mind another book I wrote. It's Richard Sennett wrote he's a social scientist, and he wrote a book called The Craftsman many years ago. And in it, he has a definition of craftsmanship, which is an enduring basic human impulse, the desire to do a job well for its own sake. And every time I read something, like there's lines in Observing the Craft that, you know, I finish it and I haven't scribbled in the note, craftsmanship. Because I think that's what this book is all about, is craftsmanship, doing something well because you want to do something well. And in the doing of it well, you make yourself better.
For those that are watching, there's a lot of nodding heads. A
lot of nodding. And that now that I've made my point, I'm going to put my mute on and not talk for the rest of the show.
I was going to say, well,
are we nodding or nodding off?
Wrap it up.
Yeah. And that really brings us to the end of the preface there. And we're really going to start breaking into the why does Observing the Craft matter? So being at our time, maybe we could wrap up and come in with the start of chapter one.
Well, I had a question about any man being a Mason. He talks in the preface about any man being a Mason.
It's a question.
And, well, can any man be a Mason? I think he's alluding, he doesn't say it directly, but I think he's alluding to the one day degrees from
big time there. He even says, calls them out. He says, no man is a Mason who's done it in a day.
Where? Oh. In the preface? Not in the preface.
Let me go to the library. I'll be back in a minute. I will find it. Well, maybe not. I don't know.
It's on the last page of the preface there. The book will argue against the idea that any man can become a Mason in one day, and further suggests that those who believe they have done so have not truly begun their journey.
Well, bless your heart, you found it.
That was where?
That's on the third to last paragraph in the
Roman numeral 19 in my book.
19.
I don't know, but I've got the fancy.
Oh yeah, you got the different one. So it's still in the preface?
It's still in the preface, yeah. It's like the second to last paragraph of the preface.
As we all rereading our books and nobody can see what we're doing. Interesting.
Along, when you hear the bell tinkle, flip the page.
Interesting. I didn't see that I must have missed it, because I didn't see that he said specifically the one day thing. Yep. He alluded to it dramatically as far as I was concerned, but.
Yeah. No, I remember reading that and going, ooh, someone's being called out. And so they should. I mean, I don't think we've ever done that up here in our jurisdiction.
No. That,
to my knowledge.
One day degrees,
no.
We had a rash of them, as I understand it, before my time.
Rash, good word.
And there's still some guys around that were part of that. And now you can't do a one day degree without having had your first degree in your home lodge. So a one day degree could only occur on the second, third degree, which wouldn't really be a one day full degree, but
yeah,
it's basically
a 2 day degree.
But was it Illinois or Iowa? This is one of the I states.
California?
They do.
I think it was Illinois.
That's the me California, state.
California, IA.
That's the I state.
It was Ohio. I think it was Ohio.
Ohio is an I state?
Yeah. O state. Okay. One of those back there in the Middle East. They do a lot of 1 day degrees. There's like, what, 50,000 Masons or something? I don't know. Some crazy number. But they have statistics that back up that for the ghost guys that are in, and then there's a higher percentage of those that are 1 day degree that stick longer than those that aren't.
They gotta learn it sometime.
Yeah.
What was it? We had a education day back in February, March. Can't remember. And I think they said that the average lifespan of a Mason in British Columbia is 6 years.
Really?
Yes.
7 years, something like that. It was basically. I think when I heard it, I thought, yeah, just long enough to get through the chairs. No, because it was because I went through it. And it's like, I think it was like either 6 or 7, which is literally if you start is just long enough to become master and then go out the door and never come back.
It's probably true.
Depending on the lodge you go to, yeah. I think it's eight years in our journey.
Yeah. If you started Junior Deacon.
No, we started Stewart's.
Well, yeah, if you got enough people to put them into the chairs. But that's a totally different episode.
Yes. So on that note, on a different episode note, since we're running out of time here, we look forward to, like I said earlier, we're going to be talking about this book for quite some time. I encourage you to go out and grab yourself a copy and read it. It's in a lot of Masonic libraries for sure, and it's available on the internets and Amazon and all that sort of stuff. And I'm getting a scowly look from Jared.
Well, I was just trying to think if it actually is. I don't think it's in our. I should actually put a copy in the library at our lodge hall.
I know
not my copy, of course.
If you purchase it from his website, I believe he'll offer an autograph.
Ooh, there you go. Thanks. And
it might take a while to get it, but you know.
So anyway, as we're wrapping up here, like I said, we encourage you to get the book, follow along in the readings. This was sort of, I guess we were talking about the preface here. We never explicitly said that, but that's basically what we did. And I look forward to hearing from you guys. If you want to post something on the social media or whatever commentary, we're going to be here for a while. So it's good to get out all the questions here. So with that, on behalf of Jared and Stephen and David and myself, I want to thank you all for listening. And we look forward to talking to you next time again on the Working Tools Podcast. Goodbye.